I approach this with some trepidation because I realize I'm in the minority on almost all relevant dimensions. I'm not using the machines. I'm one of the few lawyers here. I think my talk will be much more institutional and less theoretical than most of the talks. I'm going to resolutely approach my subject in a bottom-up way, asking at every point what's the cash value of collective wisdom for institutional design. And finally, I think I'm not sure I'm in the minority as being sort of a qualified skeptic about collective wisdom. I don't want to overstate this point. I think we've all sort of started to converge over the course of the conference on some sort of contextualism. We want to figure out the conditions under which these mechanisms make sense and not be a partisan in any direction. But I think within those limitations, my bias is towards the skeptical end. So what exactly am I skeptical about, and what are my grounds for skepticism? I'm skeptical about what I call many minds arguments in legal theory. So there's a wave of hot arguments in legal theory that I want to call these many minds arguments. More minds are in some way or another better than one. I just start with some examples. There's a lot of Burkean and Hayekian legal theory nowadays, in which customs and traditions are said to embody the collective wisdom of the broader society as it develops over time and should be incorporated into the law. Usually the idea is by judges. The same kinds of theorists say that judicial precedents aggregate the collective knowledge of many judges over time. One of their leading claims is many judicial heads are better than one. This claim comes in maybe three different variants that I can figure out. One is a Condorcetian variant. Some of these theorists apply the jury theorem extended over time to apply to a notional voting group of judges. And the idea is there's some right legal answer and standard jury theorem stuff. There's an evolutionary variant. Originally it was Hayek, but then it was picked up in standard law and economics models. Think of Richard Posner and many successors. And in these models, the common law evolves to efficiency over time as if guided by an invisible hand. The basic mechanism is that inefficient precedents create deadweight losses, which tend to be more frequently litigated, and the losers from these inefficient rules will, by definition, pay more to overturn them than the gainers will to retain them, so they tend to get weeded out. So this is interesting. This is a kind of collective, I don't know what to call it, collective wisdom mechanism that isn't tracking truth. It's, it's efficiency maximizing. It's essentially Calder-Hicks efficiency. Okay, and third, there are these hybrid models that people like Andre Schleifer and Nicola Giannioli have been playing with recently, which are kind of a hybrid of evolutionary and informational ideas. And in these models, you have a bunch of judges who distinguish cases, and just for completely ideological reasons, they distinguish past cases, but the constraint is they're only allowed to use material distinctions. And the result is as though by an invisible hand over time, the case law incorporates all available information. So you have an evolution to full information rather than to efficiency. Okay, here's another type of many minds argument in legal theory. There's a debate in the United States, which may seem very strange to my European friends. And the debate is about whether U.S. courts should consider the law of foreign states when fashioning discretionary legal rules. It may seem very strange. So in this debate, the people who say that U.S. courts should consider legal rules developed by foreign courts have made explicitly Condorcetian arguments. They say the law of foreign states provides aggregated information about optimal legal rules as if the foreign courts were voting as a group. So that's sort of all about courts. So let's not ignore legislatures. As we all know, there's a lot of recent work on deliberation in legislatures and non-deliberative Condorcetian mechanisms in legislatures. Jeremy Waldron did some of this stuff. David is recently, and Ellen are doing this stuff. Okay. So what do we have? We have this genus of many minds argumentation. I think it's internally highly heterogeneous. That is, there are many species within this genus. And that's another thing we've learned over the course of the past couple days. I break it down into the paper into Condorcetian claims, Hayekian claims, Burkean claims, and Aristotelian claims. Those are just labels that may or may not be helpful. The point is we have aggregative, evolutionary, tradition-based, deliberative, all these species within the genus. I do think it is a genus in the minimal sense that there's a common ancestor. I think the common ancestor is some bit of proverbial lore, I will not call it wisdom, that, you know, in some way many heads are better than one, and then different theorists cash this out in different ways, and it becomes more and more reticulated over time into these different species of arguments. Okay, so what's my aim in the paper? The aim in the paper is twofold. There's a splitting aim and a lumping aim. The splitting aim is to offer some analytic distinctions, to clarify some differences between the major species, just get clear on what they are. I'm not going to talk about that in the presentation. I think many of you have done this better than I have in the paper. So I'll move on to my comparative advantage, which is the lumping aim. That is, where I treat these as a genus and try to ask, what is their cash value for the design of legal institutions? And this is where my qualified skepticism comes in. I think these arguments have less cash value for the design of legal institutions than others think they do. It's not that the value is zero, it's that it's low. The mechanisms that underpin these sorts of arguments are in many cases somewhat fragile. The arguments are stylized or pitched at a pretty high level of abstraction. And there are serious problems with applying them to the thick institutions of the legal system. Okay, so let me just explain my grounds for skepticism. I put them into five rough categories. In the paper, there are only four listed explicitly. I think there's one implicit that I'm going to add, and I'll try to make it explicit as I go to revise the paper. The first general problem I call whose minds. This might be a little boring, but as a lawyer, I'm finicky about the details. And when I hear, you know, many minds are better than one, I want to know, what's the denominator? Many minds out of what group? And I think, you know, the group can make a big difference. When we clarify the denominator, often we start maybe to get nervous, or should, about some of these many minds arguments. So here's an example. I'll give two examples. The first one's pretty benign. The second one is maybe less benign. The relatively benign example is this idea of American courts taking into account the law of foreign jurisdictions on Condorcetian grounds. Seems pretty sensible to me. But one wants to ask, which foreign courts exactly ought we to count? Should we include Zimbabwe? Should we include North Korea or not? I guess the argument against including them is that those courts are of low epistemic competence, or it may be that the political distortions are so great that they're not voting sincerely on the legal issues. We just have a straightforward violation of the sincerity condition. But I'll just treat it as though it's a competence problem. The argument, I guess, for including them is, I say this slightly tongue-in-cheek, is we would reduce the correlation of biases within the virtual voting group by including North Korea. Right? And one starts to worry about the limits of diversity. Now, a suitably specified decision rule would trade off, I guess, the epistemic benefits of increasing competence by excluding these courts against the epistemic costs of increasing correlation by excluding these courts. And you'd want to figure out a group that that has maximal epistemic power, putting aside for the moment non-epistemic considerations. Fine, I just want to make a kind of lawyer's point, which is the complexity of those trade-offs is now drastically increasing the cognitive load on the judges who have to figure out what rules they should follow in deciding whether to consult the law of foreign jurisdictions. Okay, here's maybe a more serious example of ambiguity about whose minds count. There are these Burkean and Hayekian arguments that a tradition and norms, customs, different things in that neighborhood should be a source of rules either for common law or for judge-made constitutional law. I want to know, which traditions or customs or norms exactly emanating from whose minds. Sometimes the two different very different ideas are run together. Sometimes the idea is that judges should look to precedent. Sometimes the idea is that judges should look to extrajudicial societal customs and norms. But I want to say those things are so different, they shouldn't be treated under the same rubric. Precedents come from the minds of the judges. That group of minds that create precedents may be quite small. So in the case of constitutional law, to take just the United States Supreme Court, it's had 110 members, I think, in its total history. And of those 110, only maybe a dozen or at most a couple dozen have expressed views on any given question. So we're dealing with a very small number of minds, not many minds or the immemorial wisdom of the ages or something like that. And when people assimilate that to Hayekian arguments about social customs or traditions, I start to get nervous. I think there's a kind of, this is now my Benthamite side going to emerge, I think there's a kind of mystification, maybe even deliberate mystification, in calling, the work of these few identifiable Supreme Court justices the work of many minds, as though this is a part of the putatively immemorial social fabric. I say putatively because I think that Eric Hobsbawm is even righter than he knows that in law most traditions are of recent invention. Okay, second general problem, and these will get quicker, I promise. Second general problem is many minds, worse minds. The quality of minds isn't independent of their number. More minds can be systematically worse than fewer because of selection constraints, incentives for epistemic free riding, or emotional influences. We've discussed some of that in the past couple days. I'm not going to go over the epistemic free riding or emotional influence stuff. I've learned a lot hearing everybody here talk about it. I just want to mention sort of in that neighborhood that there's a analytically related problem of information cascades that we haven't discussed much, where decision-making is sequential rather than simultaneous, where you have a string of precedents, but later judges are just following the decisions of maybe one judge, right? It's the mind of Lord Mansfield, not many minds, and all subsequent judges follow this. It's a bit rich to call it the product of many minds. And, on some theories, this is the very point of precedent, that later judges should follow what the earlier judges said. So there's something paradoxical about this. It's that the judges who are the best precedent followers do the least to contribute anything independent to the informational content of the law. They're the ones who kind of draw down on what Burke called the bank and capital of ages, namely the implicit, immanent wisdom of the common law. And you can do the same kind of argument in different contexts. If foreign courts all follow the decision of the first court that heard an issue, then the informational content of subsequent decisions may be quite low, and you'd wish, somewhat paradoxically, that later judges would break from the practice of following the law of foreign courts in order that we could have more independent contributions to the law, total body of law generated by foreign courts. Okay, let me say a couple point about these selection constraints, which are not, these are not obviously endogenous effects of numbers on quality, but it's just that they're limits to the extent to which numbers can help us with quality. Selection effects can be about competence or about diversity. The competence strand is illustrated by Condorcet's, you know, famous worry that enlarged legislators' average competence would slip below the magic randomness threshold. But you could do the same thing for other institutions. There's a very brilliant passage in the Persian Letters about the competence of judges on the Parisian courts. And I'm going to tax your patience by reading this. It's short. Uzbek says of the Parisian courts, he says, decisions go by majority vote, but it is said that experience has shown that it would be better to follow the minority opinion. And that's natural enough, he continues, for there are very few good minds, and everyone agrees that there's an infinite number of bad ones. So I think there's a double irony here. Even if you might prefer the minority's view because epistemic competence is limited, it's odd to infer that from the fact that everyone thinks it's limited. But obviously, Montesquieu is playing with us. Okay, as to constraints on the amount of diversity you can get into your decision-making group, I'm not sure I have a good example. It might be that there's an example in admissions to elite colleges that goes something like this, that if you want to increase the ethnic diversity of your incoming class because that's correlated somehow with cognitive diversity, that you will have to pay a price on another margin of diversity, which is class. That is, it may be that because of the composition of the applicant pool, you will have to, minority applicants who meet the elite university's threshold will tend to be from upper middle class or upper class families. So what you gain on one margin of diversity, you may lose on another. Okay, a third general problem is what I want to call this problem of epistemic bottlenecks. Sometimes I think the epistemic benefits of many minds are diluted, maybe even eliminated, because the structure of institutions funnels decisions through a small group or a single person who occupies a kind of choke point. Let me give you an example that sounds hypothetical but is actually actual. I'm just not going to use names to protect the idiotic. We have a high constitutional court composed of 9 judges. 8 of these judges are politicians in robes. 4 of them are left politicians, 4 of them are right politicians, and they routinely split their votes 4-4. There's one judge on this court who is sincere, but this judge is of very low competence. So this judge is always the swing vote and tries to obtain the correct legal answer, but he's a kind of epistemic bottleneck. Whatever collective wisdom or intelligence would otherwise be embodied in precedents or traditions gets filtered through his limited mentation, and you get odd outcomes. Okay, here's another example what I think is a similar phenomenon, which is there may be some kind of epistemic analog of the iron law of oligarchy. So Gloria maybe can help me with this. I found a study that purports to show that 1% of Wikipedia users are responsible for half of the site's edits. So it's a little bit of not right to say that it's this great distributed, decentralized social network. It turns out, in fact, that there's an oligarchy, a very small oligarchy, who's doing doing the bulk of the work. And as one journalist put it, the wisdom of crowds tends to devolve into the wisdom of the chaperones. The editing, that's what I said. Yeah, the editing, yeah. There's another small issue in this neighborhood that I want to point to. I just haven't made much progress on it. It's what we might call the issue of epistemic agenda setting. It's been striking to me as we have seen many interesting models over the course of the past 2 days, that often in these situations, the issue is just there. It's just sort of exogenously given. One wants to know how the agenda is set. Even if everybody, all the decision makers share the same preferences, but if the results of decision making are sensitive to the order in which issues are presented, and there's an agenda setter who is epistemically limited and has to set the agenda for the whole group, it may place a constraint on the epistemic power of the whole group. My fourth and final problem, my fourth problem is I want to call many minds versus many minds. This is a point that is somewhat legal theory inside baseball, but I want to see if I can get it across. The insight that many minds can be better than one doesn't get much purchase on the institutional comparisons that you have to do a lot of the time in legal theory, which are not one mind versus many minds. There are many minds versus many minds. So take the issue of what in America we call judicial review, the power of courts to invalidate statutes on constitutional grounds. And there's a very robust theory of judicial review, school of theorists who are the common law constitutionalists, and they want judges to fill in ambiguities, gaps in a written constitution through precedents, through doctrine. And one of the things they like to say is that, many judicial minds are better than one. We'll appeal to these Condorcetian and evolutionary mechanisms, Aristotelian mechanisms. It's my colleague Frank Michelman. And we'll say that many judges will do better than one judge will do. But where a statute is challenged is inconsistent with these precedents, I don't think the issue is whether many judges will do better than one judge will do. I think the issue is whether many judges will do better than many legislators will do. And if we assume sincere voting on all sides just to isolate the epistemic issues, it's not at all obvious to me that the epistemic capacities of the judiciary over time are developing precedent over time are superior to the epistemic capacities of a very large legislature voting at a given time. In fact, Jeremy Waldron and David and Ellen have gone some way to developing the legislative side of this comparison, and I think there's even more work to be done on it. What's striking here is that the theorists of the collective wisdom of legislatures and democracy in general are appealing to the same mechanisms that the theorists of judicial override of democracy are appealing to. Right? So you have these two groups of theorists, both of whom are appealing to the same Condorcetian, Aristotelian kind of families of mechanisms. What you have to do is do a comparison of institutions in light of these mechanisms and see what comes out. I don't offer a view about that comparison here, but I think that's the way to go. My fifth general problem, the one I'm going to try to make more explicit in the paper, is something that I think has come up at several points in the past 2 days. And the idea is that collective wisdom should be optimized, not maximized. Collective wisdom should be optimized, not maximized. I put that in consequentialist lingo. If I were smarter, I could also put it in non-consequentialist lingo. I'm sure David Eslin could do this for me in his sleep. But I'll just put it in consequentialist lingo. And I just mean that, look, collective wisdom, I think, systematically trades off against other non-epistemic desiderata that we have. And if that's true, then we wouldn't want to maximize collective wisdom. We'd want the kind of amount or distribution or whatnot of collective wisdom that would be optimal overall. So one point I've been trying to make the past couple days is I think collective wisdom mechanisms trade off against the costs of decision making. This is, you know, maybe something that lawyers care about, which isn't glamorous, but you could imagine, you know, that old standard Buchanan and Tulloch diagram that plots the the optimal, exactly right. It's optimal legislative size by plotting transaction costs against externalities. And so you could do an epistemic version of this, right? So you don't want to pick the legislative size that just gives you the highest point on the net epistemic benefits curve. You want the point that optimizes against the costs of decision-making, both direct costs and opportunity costs. Here's another example of trading off collective wisdom against other non-epistemic desiderata. I think the I could go back to my Zimbabwe and North Korea thing. I think the kind of obvious argument against including Zimbabwe and North Korea in the pool of foreign court decisions that one consults isn't that, you know, some of these sophisticated calculations of ability versus diversity. I think the obvious argument for not including them is to make a statement about our political values, that we don't, you know, we think that North Korea is not, we don't want in any way to endorse the decisions of North Korean officials, and we're just not going to look at them. And so we, if that's right, we'd be, if our epistemically desirable decision rule would otherwise include North Korea, we'd just be sacrificing a little bit of that for to make a statement about values, and that seems perfectly sensible to me. Okay, by way of conclusion, let me just say one word to clarify what I take to be the import of these problems. I just see them as creating a succession of filters. So we have some initial very large set of many minds arguments, at least that legal theorists are throwing around. And I just want to filter them out one by, you know, impose four or five successive filters. We get rid of some of them as ill-specified, some of them as making false comparisons, some of them as resting on fragile mechanisms that don't really work in the given context. Some of them just kind of implausible. So, and there's some subset of many minds arguments that will pass through all these filters. I just don't think it's going to be that large. So that's the sense in which I'm a skeptic. Thank you.
I'm not going to try to summarize Adrian's paper, for it's so dense that I would have to reproduce it in extenso. But I'll comment on a few selected issues. Since I agree with most of the paper, these will be pretty minor. I'll make two comments on the Condorcet theorem, one comment on the efficiency of the common law, one comment on the doctrinal paradox, one comment on tradition, one comment on presidential cascades, and added at the last minute, one brief comment on the costs of decision-making. Okay. Now, Adrian has many interesting things to say about the Condorcet jury theorem, and I mostly agree with his skepticism. But I have a couple of remarks, really puzzles. The first concerns the alleged polling model of the interpretation. On page 5, he writes that, quote, as the sample drawn out of some larger population increases and the other assumptions of the theorem are met, it is increasingly likely that the majority of the sample group tracks what the majority of the underlying population would choose. Although I haven't read the article by Edelman, to which Adrian refers, this seems a trivial idea, because in a limit, the majority of the sample group becomes identical with the majority of the population, so it's not surprising that the sample tracks the population. And my question, which really is a one of ignorance, is whether this really is a direct formal application or implication of the theorem. My second comment on what Adrian writes on the Condorcet theorem concerns what looks like an inconsistency between two passages concerning the relation between the theorem and epistemic free riding. Because on page 21, he asserts that, quote, the epistemic free riding problem is built into the very structure of the theorem. But on page 25, however, he assumes that when, quote, all members of the relevant population vote or judge or deliberate or act independently, there is no free riding. And it sounds to me as if that statement would include the Condorcet setting. I'm sure I'm missing something here, and I'm sure Adrian will tell me what it is. Now, I have full sympathy for the evolutionary argument, for a criticism of the evolutionary argument of the efficiency, for the efficiency of the common law. But let me just raise one minor question. He asserts that the basic mechanism for this alleged trend towards efficiency is that inefficient rules will impose deadweight losses and will therefore be more likely challenged by litigants. I thought, but I'm probably wrong, that the most cited mechanism was the following. Judges who make bad decisions are more likely to lose an appeal, which is something judges don't want to happen. But maybe if there are several mechanisms converging to the same result, the speed of adjustment or correction might be more likely to catch up with the rate of change of the environment, which is one of Adrian's main arguments in the paper. Now, returning to a point we discussed yesterday concerning the doctrinal paradox, Adrian asserts that the group judgment in the three-judge case is incoherent. I'm wondering why he says that. It would be incoherent if we impose as a normative desideratum that the premise-based and a conclusion-based group judgment should always coincide. Well, for one thing, this is certainly a weaker form of incoherence than the one that Arrow proved. Also, I wonder whether it's as undesirable as cycling preferences. I would have thought that the tendency of the law would always be to go for the conclusion-based judgment, since that is more compatible with the kind of judicial minimalism that is advocated by Cass Sunstein. When different judges reach the same majority of conclusion from different premises, that's just fine. To require them to reach a form of majority agreement on the premises, notably if one of them is a controversial point of law, would be too demanding. I was also a bit worried by a verbal ambiguity in what Adrian says about tradition. He seems, on page 11 and 12, to use the terms tradition and traditionalism as synonymous. But in much of the literature, these are viewed as different ideas. Traditionalism is to do at all times exactly what we did at some time, T star, in the past. That was a typo, Adrian.
Which one is a typo?
On the line 7 on page. Tradition is to do at any time T what we did at T time minus 1. Mm. Not exactly the same, but the same plus or minus epsilon. So traditionalism is conscious, fixed, rigid, and incapable of learning. Tradition is non-conscious, flexible, and capable of adjustments. Both traditionalism and tradition exclude large radical breaks with the past. Tradition allows for small changes in a kind of gradient climbing, but does not allow us to move from a local maximum to the higher global maximum. But the Burkean response to this limitation of tradition, response also found in Keynes, is that the human mind is too limited to enable us to locate the global maximum. Next, a question on precedential cascades. I'm referring to page 24. The way I understand cascade theory, cascades are especially likely to produce low-quality beliefs in the following situation. In a sequential process, each agent forms a belief on the basis of his or her private information and on the conclusion of the beliefs formed by the agent who came before him or her in the process. And the point is that the process can derail because each agent doesn't have access to the private information of earlier agents in the process. But I would have thought that in judicial cases, each court has access not only to the rulings, the conclusions of the previous courts, but also to the premises, often very extensive, on which those rulings were based. So a priori, therefore, the risk of cascading should be less in courts than, for instance, the risk of an external grader being excessively influenced by an internal grader when he only knows the final grade of the internal grader and not the premises of that internal grader. And finally, concerning the cost of decision-making, in my opinion, wisdom is, I think somebody said this yesterday, precisely the ability of reason to recognize its own limits. That's what Pascal said, among many others. Or Descartes, the principle, subtlety is never to use subtlety. So it's precisely to ignore the cost of decision-making is precisely the sign of an unwise decision-maker. Let me just use an example I've studied in the past, the allocation of child custody in disputed custody cases. In all Western countries, the law says that custody should follow the best interest of the child. And in most countries, the decision, the identification of the parent who is best apt to have custody from the point of view of the child is made by conflictual, often very prolonged, very hostility-creating judicial process involving interaction between judges, psychological experts, and the parents. Suppose, contrary to my belief, that this process is in fact likely to get us to the conclusion that would have been optimal if it had been reached instantly. Yeah. Now, that shows that would ignore the immense cost that the process itself imposes on a child and ignore the fact that the process of deciding what is in the best interest of the child might go against the best interest of the child. So wisdom, in this case, would require, I suggest, flipping a coin and ignore this sort of pseudo-rational search for precision. Thank you.
Great. So what should I do? Should I... Okay. I'll try to give answers to most of them. There are a couple where I'm not actually sure where the quote is. But anyway, I'll just try to answer the ones I can do easily. So here, let me go backwards through them. On the last point, I don't think we have a substantive disagreement. Yes, right. If we build decision-making costs into wisdom, fine. All I mean to point out is that some of the desiderata-like diversity, you know, that give us epistemic gains, give us costs on the amount of time that it takes to reach decisions, stuff like that. So that's okay. The question on precedential cascades, yes. In some counterfactual world, that would be right, but. In our world, a striking number of our legal rules, especially common law rules, come to us from a period when either there were no opinions accompanying decisions, we just had decisions.
I was thinking of Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, okay. Or even for the Supreme Court, my second point still holds, come from eras of false consensus. That is, it wasn't until late in the 19th century that Supreme Court justices started issuing dissenting opinions concurring opinions. Majority opinions were nominally issued by the Chief Justice, arrived at by a process of internal bargaining that might not reflect anyone's sincerely held beliefs. Tradition and traditionalism... of course, these two things tend to collapse if there are inadvertent copying errors. That is, if people who think that their decision rule is to do at all times exactly what we did at some time T-star in the past make inadvertent copying errors, then you will get tradition, you know, plus or minus with some kind of variance around it. The comparison of gradient climbing to limited deliberate action. Right, this is the Hayekian theme that constructivism, as he called it, may not reach the global maximum anyway. And this is just the terrain for all of David's and Ellen's arguments. They think that, institutionally, you know, if you get enough minds in a legislature, they can do better than tradition. Incoherence. Yeah, we talked about this with Christian yesterday, and I basically think you're right that it's very hard for me to figure out a sense in which group incoherence is in which the group is incoherent. Suppose a judicial opinion says, as Christian says, P, if P, then Q, not Q, but there are different majorities for each of these propositions. I think it's only incoherent in the following very thin sense, which may not satisfy you. The judges often explicitly write opinions as though they have a collective identity. They say, we, the Supreme Court. They don't say, me, Anthony Kennedy. They say, we, the Supreme Court, in the first part of our decision, by majority rule, we hold P, we hold if P, then Q, and we hold not Q. And then, so they're anthropomorphizing themselves. So in that sense, there is an incoherence. A related point I want to make is that if a lot of people in the population do rationally or irrationally anthropomorphize the court and see the court issuing these patterns of decisions that would be incoherent if issued by a single mind, then the court may lose legitimacy, and we might want to count that as a cost. It would be a kind of derived cost of anthropomorphization. Okay. Yeah, the law and economics models about the common law.
Agree that judicial minimalism will tend to suggest conclusion based?
Yes. Yeah. Leave things. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Don't. Right. Okay. A quick word about evolutionary models of the common law and law and economics. The first generation kind of classic models didn't have appeal. These were just litigants deciding whether to try to get the court to overturn a precedent in the future. Appeal can work one of two ways. If the higher court judges are deliberately aiming to maximize the law's efficiency, then we're in a different family of models altogether, right? It's not an invisible hand model. It's an intentional action model. If the point is that we have an appeal structure, but the inefficient precedents are more likely to be appealed because they're imposing deadweight losses, then this boils down to the same Priest-Rubin model. The polling model interpretation of the theorem. This is where I just want to hear from Scott and Christian and people. I think that the math is essentially the same. It may be like a trivial case, but I think the math is essentially the same. That's all I had to say.
To comment on another point, but since you've now raised a polling interpretation, here's what I would say about this. I mean, certainly the fact that the majority verdict within a sample converges to the majority verdict in the underlying population as the sample size increases, that is certainly a statistical fact. But I don't think it should be described as being a corollary of the Condorcet-Drury theorem, although, of course, both of these stem from certain law of large numbers effects.
Yes.
But the reason why I think this is conceptually different from the Condorcet-Drury theorem is that the Condorcet-Drury theorem refers to the case where you've got some exogenous state of the world about which individuals receive stochastic signals. And then the question is whether or not the majority of those signals correctly tracks the exogenous state of the world. But here, in your case, you're not, in the polling case, you're not looking at any exogenous state of the world, but basically you're looking at the opinions within the sample and comparing them with the opinions within the larger population. And
right.
So that's why I think conceptually you're dealing with something different. No exogenous state of the world even needs to be assumed in order to model the polling effect.
I should just say, great, got it, and stop. I just want to say that people like Nicholas Miller just divide they just slice up the pie differently than you do. They don't want to stipulate that an exogenous right answer is essential to the jury theorem, or put differently, they want to use the jury theorem label where there's no exogenous right answer and just say that it's synonymous with the law of large numbers, so both these things are applications of the same mathematical point. But I don't really care. We can do it that way if we want. Yeah.
Is there still time to make the other point?
Yeah.
I also wanted to briefly comment on Jan's comments about the doctrinal paradox and the coherence problems. I think the original doctrinal paradox concerned the possibility of a discrepancy between the outcome of a premise-based and a conclusion-based procedure. And now that's of course a very important and interesting point, but I think it's conceptually, it's closely related, but nonetheless conceptually subtly different from the point which is emphasized in the more recent work on judgment aggregation, namely that simultaneous majority voting on multiple logically connected propositions can lead to inconsistent collective judgments. Now, if the propositions that are being voted on explicitly include logical connections, as in the case of P, if P, then Q, Q, then these inconsistencies that can arise under majority voting are immediately transparent. They are just standard logical inconsistencies. Now, in the case that Jan was worried about or concerned about, the inconsistency is not immediately transparent from the formulation of the propositions, because the let's say the majority accepts P, the majority accepts Q, so those are maybe two premises, and the majority accepts not R, which is the negation of some conclusion. And an inconsistency comes into play only once you further stipulate some background connection rule which says R if and only if P and Q. Mathematically speaking, nonetheless make all the results on judgment aggregation and so on applicable by introducing the notion of conditional consistency, namely consistency relative to whatever background constraints you want to impose. And then we can have a debate about what the background constraints should be in a judicial case, relative to which we want to assess the consistency of courts. And people may reasonably disagree about this. I mean, minimalists may want to say perhaps there are none or very few such constraints, whereas, perhaps very comprehensive deliberativists would want to say there are very stringent such background constraints. And, I mean, even in the Arovian model, there are these background constraints. A binary relation of the form, XPY, YPZ, ZPX is not unconditionally inconsistent. It is inconsistent relative to the background constraint of transitivity. It's just that as a sort of general constraint of rationality or so, we readily accept this background constraint, and therefore we don't always mention it.
Oh, great. I mean, did you want to?
My main point was really whether a certain philosophy or constitutional interpretation, let's minimalism, would worry a great deal about this.
Sure.
That was really
No, I think we are in agreement on that.
I just want to cash out your point, Christian, in political terms by saying just the larger the set of propositions one has to consult before the inconsistency becomes apparent, the lower the legitimacy costs of group-level incoherence. That's all, right.
Yes, my point is about your fourth point. Many minds versus many minds.
Yes.
In fact, I believe that the truth of the matter is few minds versus many minds, because judges are less numerous than legislators. Yes. So what worries me in this doctrine of collective wisdom is that it is either extremely revisionary or incomplete. Extremely revisionary, because if it's correct, we should dismantle judicial review everywhere in the world. And the only country which fits with the theory are United Kingdom and perhaps China. or the doctrine is incomplete because we should make sense of few people controlling a large bunch of people. You see the point? I mean, that asking this question seems to me extremely important, and I'm surprised that you are the only person, perhaps because you are a lawyer.
Because what?
You are a lawyer, and you know that there is judicial review.
So there are many interesting complexities here. I tried to make this point about few judicial minds and under the heading of my first point, and then in the later sections kind of grant the common law constitutionalists their assumptions. Suppose we thought with David and Ellen that on some, let's just, for example, use the jury theorem, on some Condorcetian metrics that legislatures were superior to these small court because of numerosity and diversity and stuff. One reaction could be to change the court's jurisdiction. Another could be to change the court's composition and institutional arrangement. So if we really diversity for epistemic reasons, we could try to introduce more diversity into the judicial system. We could have non-lawyers on high constitutional courts, for example.
As in France,
exactly. I have a recent paper arguing for non-lawyer justices on the U.S. Supreme Court on exactly these grounds. So I don't think the institutional response is uniquely determined once we accept the David Allen line of argument. There are many paths we can follow.
The French are very unhappy with the person who is not a lawyer in the court. It's a different point.
Yeah, that actually leads right into my question, because it seems like the way you were looking at the, you know, what does the many minds argument have to say to the law was very constrained. And an alternative way to look at it would be exactly the direction you've gone in the other work, is to say one thing it suggests right away is that maybe we shouldn't have all lawyers on the Supreme Court, or at a minimum, the clerks. I mean, it seems to me, in light of, you know, what I've learned over the last 5 or 6 years in this area, it seems just crazy to me to think that if I'm a Supreme Court judge and I'm going to have, you know, 5 or 6 people helping me write the law, that I'm going to pick 5 or 6 people that came from 3 schools that are all 24 years old, that have all been trained in the same way. When, you know, why wouldn't I pick Jan, right? I think you'd probably be a much better clerk than, you know, the average person I'm plucking out of Yale or Harvard. Right? No, you know what I'm saying. But then there's other things I think that come into play when you think about just more generally about, like, let's take jury selection, right? One thing we've talked a lot about how is it's, you know, you need sort of, I think, diverse, capable people. And that suggests a very different thinking about what jury makeup should be, perhaps in a murder trial versus insider trading on Wall Street. I mean, people on Wall Street complain all the time about how jury trials are just a mess because nobody knows anything about what's going on. And so people don't have that base level of knowledge that's necessary in order to get the right outcome. But even pushing it further, when you think about the whole notion of sort of, at least in the U.S. system, of confrontational, you know, you've got two sides, right? Well, that in some sense is limiting diversity right off the bat. So why, if it's the case, if on something like insider trading, you know, why don't I bring in 3 other disinterested parties to just sort of, you know, toss out their opinion on the matter? Why do we restrict it to 2? So it just seems like once I have this idea that lots of different ways of looking at a problem help us get to truth, you know, help us get the better answer, why don't I then, you know, look at the entire legal system and ask, are there ways in which we would change things? Because, I mean, I find it incredibly ironic that people are using precedent as an argument for using diversity as an argument for precedent. Seems just completely counterintuitive. Right.
Okay, so let me try to put this in a more systematic framework by saying that if we have a misallocation of tasks to institutions, in principle, there are always 2 types of responses. We can reallocate the tasks or redesign the institutions, right? And your comment, my thing about having non-lawyer justices and your recent comments are all under the second heading. So we'd want to compare the costs and benefits of those 2 modes of proceeding. Let me just give you one of my non-hypothetical parables with the names deleted to illustrate one of the costs of some of the approaches you mentioned. So take a Supreme Court justice who worries about epistemic diversity. So deliberately makes, this justice is conservative. This justice deliberately makes an effort every year to hire as one of his four law clerks a liberal Democrat, okay? So to introduce epistemic diversity into the chambers. A laudable goal. But then when it comes to actual discussion about cases, this justice just happens to think over and over again that the liberal Democrat is wrong, right? This is an illustration of this epistemic bottlenecks problem that I'm talking about. The diversity is being funneled through, right, okay, so.
Well, now that leads into my question, because I have a question about the bottleneck sort of argument, in particular the agenda-setting version. Just a little thought about that. So there's two ways we might worry about agenda-setting in this context. One would be the kind of iron law of bureaucracy argument, which is it's set in some defective way exogenously to the decision procedure. Right. Now, there's a kind of a good news, bad news for the collective wisdom thing in this case. The bad news is, in absolute terms, that's just going to push down the quality of any decision procedure, right? But if the question is, which decision procedure should we use, this is just a parameter. We're stuck with this. Mm-hmm. Now, consult one or consult many. Consult many. Another way in which agenda setting might figure in, and I don't think you meant to consider this case, and I don't have any great examples, is when, and it seems likely there must be good examples of this, where the choice between, say, consulting one or consulting many will endogenously affect the agenda setting. Right? And it seems likely we could cook up cases where it makes that kind of difference, and that seems well worth studying.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. I'd like to see a Lenz next book, for example, could be, let's take all these models that I had in my first book and complicate them on various margins. One margin is, let's consider the role of agenda setting. Another margin is, let's introduce heterogeneity among the agents. Let's have some be sincere voters and some insincere voters. Another complication would be to have institutions with multiple tasks, so not some epistemic type tasks and some non-epistemic type tasks, and look at the interaction between those. So there are an infinite number of complications one can develop.
Adrian, I'm really glad you gave this paper, because it's good to have a sort of toning down a little bit the enthusiasm about collective wisdom. And also, I think it shows the limits of hasty arguments, that hasty many minds argument applied a little bit not very carefully. So I think what's important is indeed to define the community that we're talking about and make sure that they share a sufficient basis of common values. So define an epistemic framework, if you will. So it can work for a nation or a country or a small group who's trying to figure out an answer to a given problem, like the situation of the 12 angry men I gave. But pulling North Korea with the United States on subject that they just have very different worldviews, and they don't overlap. So I don't think that's a very good argument. So I think what your paper shows is more the limits of, the fact that we should be careful in using those many minds arguments. Not necessarily that many minds arguments are wrong. Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to say is relates to Pasquale's point about should we get rid of judicial review. And I want to connect that to that notion of collective wisdom across time. I think Jan insisted that wisdom might be the ability to recognize one's limits. So maybe one of the elements of the wisdom of groups is that they know when they fail. Remember, many minds' arguments don't say that the group always knows better. I mean, systematically knows. I mean, always knows better. It's a probabilistic argument. So we will fail collectively. Often. So now, can we figure out when we fail? And if we know when we fail, then shouldn't we prevent ourselves from failing? And that doesn't mean that, that just justifies oligarchy. It just means we can, Ulysses tying himself to the mast. It's self-binding in a way. So it's not so much that the many should be controlled by the few. It's the many should control themselves, possibly through an independent entity like a judicial review. Although I would say making those few completely untouchable, like it is a case, is a bad idea. So I would promote something like the Swiss situation, where they have a referendum post decision by the few, actually. So there is like a circularity of the, you know, you start with a judgment of the many, controlled by a judgment by the few, and then this is again checked by a judgment by the many. So you sort of have this diachronic wisdom of the group with steps. I don't know if it's clear, but...
So on the first part, I wholeheartedly agree. Look, I think over the course of this conference, we've all been, if you imagine a spectrum running from 0 to 100, where 0 is no many minds arguments are correct, and 100 is they're all, and we've all converged to the kind of 60-40 band. But I sense, so in a lingering way, that some of us are at the 60 point and some of us are at the 40 point. Maybe that's the best we can hope for. On the second point, I was persuaded by Jan's second book that in politics people never bind themselves, only others, or try to. So not sure, but maybe if I knew more about the Swiss institution.
I have a quick question to Scott, triggered by something Hélène just said. Does diversity to be beneficial require overlap?
Of
among the diverse individuals, can there be too much diversity?
It's more bad diversity. So
well, North Korea.
Well, I think it depends. But I mean,
I think there's two ways to slice it. One is the sort of fundamental versus instrumental slicing, right? So if we have fundamentally different preferences, then. I strongly believe that our preferences drive our worldviews, right? So one reason why, so political scientists tend to believe that diverse preferences create nothing but problems, and I actually disagree with that because the fact is that if even though it does create voting problems and creates consistency problems, the fact is it drives different worldviews, and because of that, you might get better solutions. So a very specific example that drives this home is a lot of companies in the United States had to hire environmental engineers over the last 10 or 15 years because of new regulations, and in many cases, even though these regulations impose new constraints, the solutions that were found to meet these constraints lowered cost. So they actually saved money because of a new constraint. And there's a sort of a common framing that constraint drives innovation. But the reason these constraints lowered cost, because you had people coming in working for auto companies and energy companies who didn't care about producing the best car at the cheapest price. They cared about something else. And their different vision, right, their different preferences led them to see things in different ways and enabled them to find solutions that the other people weren't looking for. So that would be an argument in some sense that perhaps, you know, a lack of overlap doesn't cause problems. But in this particular case, when you think of the law, I think it's the context, the on-the-ground life experience of someone in North Korea and Zimbabwe is very different than life experience in the United States. To the extent to which the law is based on sort of empirical premises about behavior and implications if you set this down as sort of a legal code, it just doesn't seem like the rules that would work in one place necessarily transfer to work in another place. So, for example, if I've been setting policy for an elementary school, right, that may work really well if I go become a dean, right, but it might not work really well if I were to go set policy within the military, right? And the reason it would work well for a dean, if I've got a whole bunch of people that lack sort of self-control and think they're incredibly important and are, you know, full of energy, like academics and elementary school children, right, that knowledge may transfer. But if I went to the military where people wanted, you know, where I dealt with a lifetime of people who follow rules, I think it wouldn't. So I think it's context dependent as to whether or not there can be too much or not.
Just to prolong this recent exchange, it seems to me that if you put together the diachronic perspective that Hélène and others have insisted on and what Scott just said, I think that I it's a conjecture. I haven't thought about it, but it comes to my mind that diversity is, and also what you said about local maxima. As you know, the one technique that Scott knows very well is, you know, to get out of a local maxima is to introduce disorder, chaos. So you mix, and so the thing gets out of its local maximum and jumps, or minimum, and jumps to a higher maximum. And so non-overlapping a non-overlapping situation plus a diachronic a time scale allows for this chaos to get us to a better maximum. So I think it would make sense in such cases, right? Right, the picture's on the board, right.
Right, we were talking about this. Yeah,
but another form of overlap is what you showed us, Scott, on one of your slides, where you know you had squares, partial squares, and in the case when they don't overlap, literally, right. Then it doesn't work.
Right, that's right. So thank you. We're going to take a short break, 10-minute break. We're going to take a short break.